Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Professional Awesome Racing's Hypercritical Radio. I am Hayden.
Michael Lewin.
Devin Giles.
Daniel O'Donnell.
And we have a returning guest. So, who is that?
It's Micah McMahon, that engineer nerd who gets to talk fun with Mike and hopefully dilute some things down to a digestible level.
I'm gonna shut up. So I just did this again, but I'm gonna shut up more now. So I'm gonna let you talk more because I talk too much.
No worries.
So go now. You speak now. Quick,
Oh,
go.
I speak now. I speak now. All right.
If I'm not filling space, you gotta fill space.
So
some things.
yeah,
Go ahead, Dan.
I'm gonna speak. Fuck you.
Fair enough. Someone take turn.
We obviously talked for quite some time yesterday. Mike talked. We all listened, and it was enjoyable.
Yesterday?
Or, last podcast, whatever. It all blends together in my mind.
What year is it?
I don't know.
And
That's a
there
dog.
was important things Micah wanted to talk about that we wanted to all complain about with him. So, what was the first thing on the list?
So one of the ones was, aside from bad ideas that I constantly give to Devin and some others in the group, I know Mike knows one of my Easter egg cards I want to do is a bad idea, is rule books and the lack of parity in Time Attack as a whole. You would think with how small the community is and how few governing bodies there are internationally, they could have some level of parity to help promote growth, and particularly even the US between GTA and GridLife, which has been obviously growing and they become a monster in themselves. Like some amount of parity to hop back and forth between the two. And to do it, you almost have to have a specific built car that is flexible enough to go between the two to be competitive in both, or you just completely write one off. And it's kind of a shame.
Do you think it's because GTA is kind of West Coast and GridLife is kind of Midwest?
Not really. I mean, GTA does like what, three events a year now? Realistically, they usually have an East Coast stop. They'll do like Atlanta or something, right?
Sure.
Or they used to do in New Jersey Motorsports Park or something. They have a stop on the East Coast, and they of course have Super Lap Battle, which is no longer obviously California. Why am I brain farting? Oh my goodness. Yeah, it's at COTA. It's in Tejas. Yeah, they go to Austin. And then, of course, then they have the California stops, right? So it's not like they're kind of small. And to me, I'll still say Super Lap Battle in my mind is, and Streets of Willow sort of stuff is still kind of pinnacle time attack in the US, right? Like they're kind of iconic things. The Super Lap Battle is its own iconic thing because it is the name. So COTA has become Super Lap Battle, which is in and of itself the title, right? That everybody wants. And the old school guys then also, of course, think Streets of Willow and that
Button
whole side
Willow.
of things.
Button Willow.
Or I'm sorry,
Button
Button Willow,
Willow.
Streets of Willow. Yeah, Button Willow, thank
Yeah.
you.
No, we care about the shittier track, not the better track.
Yes, fair enough. Button Willow is kind of the old school record, right? So the old school guys kind of like, that's the one you want to go hit, right? That's where the guys used to go run and set records. Nowadays, Super Lap Battle is kind of the conjoined, all right, we're going to show up and do the thing. It's a big event, and it's COTA. It's an F1 track. It's amazing, majestic. It takes a big power car to run on there fast, and you got to make sure your shit's together because you blow it up. It's really expensive cleanup at that track. So that's kind of a high risk, high reward sort of thing. Then you got GridLife that kind of came in. I remember, refresh my memory, was it 2019 that they got together and we're kind of talking like you're going to have parity between the rule books or 2020, somewhere in there.
What?
They got
They had
together
a at PR
with SEMA and PRI, or SEMA,
PRI.
one of them. And they're like, yeah, we're going to get together and have more cohesive rule books. And they're like, oh, great, finally. Like, no two totally separate rule books. And then it's like, GTA has stuck with the rules hard and fast. Like they're like Southern Baptists, and this is what it says, and there's no getting around it.
The Southern Baptists of
fire
Time
and
Attack.
brimstone, this is what it says. It is written in stone. You cannot change this rule. Like
Well,
I've had just
they change rules. They don't change them as often as.
now, and I'll say correct. So I think there's happy ground in the middle. The other group, GridLife, they kind of bend over to anybody and everybody who whines enough. They get their thing, so everybody gets that thing. The fact that you have street cars with billet drop knuckles, street class, which is enthusiast class equivalent, I'm doing air quotes here, in GTA world, and you go, are you insane? Like you can't get billet drop knuckles until I think what's their limited class, right? Like track modified or whatever you want to call the name, right? So you kind of get these parodies of the classes, but they're so different now. Like you cannot build one car for the other. So a car that I'd want to build that I'll kind of just gonna spoil it because I know I'm not going to get around to it because I've got other things that are more important is I'd want to do a BRZ for it, right? So I want to do a BRZ with an FA24, easy family swap. I want to put an 8 HP behind it. I'd really want to do a dual clutch, but GTA wouldn't allow a dual clutch at all. 100% not allowed. dual clutch transmission in their mind is the best transmission that ever existed in the world, and so you're automatically thrown into unlimited. Much less it's a
race brand sequential, sir.
Oh yeah, right? Yeah, it's a super chunky sequential that you have to buy an aftermarket controller and have all kinds of problems to tease with, and yeah. So anyway. So they think of it that way, and so I kind of wiggled my way around them, and I said, well, what if I have an automatic? Because you said I can upgrade automatics. So like, okay. It's like, so if I put an 8 HP into a BRZ, is that allowed? Well, it will have to be an automatic car first. You're not allowed to do like a manual to automatic swap, even though I never thought that would ever happen. So I don't know if they've changed the rules for that, but it becomes one of these, like, you have to poke holes to find things to be able to do something that's a junkyard swap for a streetcar class. Like, it's gotten ridiculous. And on the other hand, you've got completely off the shelf, like not off the shelf, but like billet bespoke race car parts, literally like designed to be race car parts going in street class and the other guys. And their street class is the enthusiast class, the lower class for GTA. And it's just that I feel like they're totally unequal grounds. Like what is street class now for grid life is what I think Unlimited Time Attack was, say, 10 to 15 years ago.
But it's weird because there's no aero. So that's the other thing there, that...
Yeah, it's minimal aero.
But yeah, the difference... Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
Well, as a purveyor of aerodynamic car parts, it's such a bummer that...
Yeah.
That a class that would suit our products really well and that we have a vehicle that we could...
Aren't that complicated? Yeah. Aren't that anything?
Yeah, that we could show off our parts on so they're most relatable to our customers... We can't really
right,
do just it
simple track cars. Yeah.
For grid life easily.
Well, you can't do it for, I mean, enthusiasts a little bit, but like enthusiasts is funny because you can't do too much, but then you can make a decent amount of horsepower, just like street mod you can make forever horsepower.
If I recall the rules for street mod with grid life, like if I recall, it's what you can do under tray. I can't remember how many inches, 4 inches or 2 inches, whatever, past the front bumper, sort of thing. Silhouette.
I think it's five now.
Is it five now for street mod? Anyway,
it's four or five.
So you can do an under tray back to the center line of the front axle, and likewise, and you can do a rear diffuser from the rear axle back, which is pretty much useless because you don't have the attached flow of the under tray. Blah blah blah. Anyway, so this whole like I don't know $100 sheet of Alumilite that you could put between the front axle, you know, and the rear axle. However, it's like this godsend of power and speed that all these crazy expensive parts you can now buy are not allowed in. It just blows my mind.
Yeah.
It makes no sense.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. I disagree. I agree. Like, and the other thing, too, is like you can't have an under tray, right? You can't have an under tray. But
that's
people
what I mean
skirted
by,
that rules anyway because they just didn't connect it all the way across.
Yeah.
So if there was
or
a gap,
you say they're your side skirts that run
bottom.
Almost to center line. I've got a millimeter gap between my left side skirt and my right side skirt. You know, yeah.
Right.
There's all kinds of ways we can, you know, cheat rules, but by the intent of the rule.
Right. And we've talked about that. And we talked about Tony Circa's been on it, right? Tony's been on the podcast. Abe's been on the podcast. And, you know, we've talked to both of them about it. And we've been asked about the rules for both series in that regard multiple times. And it's, every single time anybody asks, it's just like, man, just do whatever you want because it's your series and I don't want to be a part of it.
Yeah.
It's like, I'll give you some technical background of what I think. If it's like, how good is this aero change? How good would you say this is? How important is it? Right.
Yeah.
And if it changes, you know, substantially, it's like, okay, maybe that's not the best thing to do. And yeah, so we've been in those types of conversations plenty of times to, you know, make rules that make sense, if you will, from that perspective. Because if you need a technical, if you want to understand something that you don't understand necessarily technically, then yeah, you ask an expert, that makes sense. But otherwise, we've always gave the advice that like, you do what you want because I don't want to be a part of this.
Yeah.
And you got to own your own series, right? Like that's the hard part. And so that's where I think like, if you look at the rule sets, right? Like grid lives are a lot more complicated now than GTA, at least from my perspective, when I read them last. And you know, that can be good and bad until you get to SCCA or NASA rules where it's like, oh my God, shoot me in the face.
Honestly, with what Grid Life is doing to the street class, they're either going to completely ruin the class or they need to go to something more like NASA STTT where it's, you know, an average horsepower type of thing. Like this whole turbo rule that they have, it's basically going to become an Evo class. It's stock turbo or what was it, 40 millimeters, I think is the inlet. I can't remember what it was. Essentially want to put a flat plate restrictor on it. It's been like 2 months or so now since I've looked at it.
They tweaked it a little bit. So I noticed this. I forgot who pointed out to me, so appreciate whoever messaged me. I'm not going to remember your name, but it says now in the rules, for clarity, turbos utilizing 16G size compressors are considered to be legal, which opens up kind of a strange world because the 16G can kind of be anything.
Can be anything. Yeah. What are we talking about? Yeah, if we talk about 16Gs, now we're starting
16G, and it's still 16G. Like, and this is one of my other things is you have, not to get you guys in trouble or myself in trouble, but you have people writing rules for things they don't understand.
I mean, like I said, we've talked to Abe a little bit about that and such, and he was asking about the turbo rule and what's the best way to deal with it. And I'm like, I mean, the way you're at, it's hard to deal with it. Airflow is horsepower, so if you want to do the airflow way, but the problem is there's no way to know. There's no compressor maps for every turbo. It doesn't exist. There's no way to know. If you just want to limit horsepower, limit horsepower. You kind of get what I'm saying?
And that's what I meant by you have the dyno and here's your average horsepower and that's what you get. And it's a power to weight class, like ST or TT with NASA. Because that's ultimately what they want you to be hamstrung by.
Yeah.
Almost becomes a GLTC because then sliding scale of tires. Remember, you guys... Was it the Time Attack forums way back in 2008, 9, 10, 11, somewhere in there? You guys remember those? This stuff came up when it was still Redline Time Attack, and we were talking about street class rules then, and sliding scale, well, then it's not fair because tires and power and weight and all sort of shit. And this has been an argument that's been going on for 15 years for Time Attack in the U.S.
And it's even, back in the day, put it in perspective, enthusiast class used to be relatively open. In terms of power, I don't think it's still as open, right? GT has clamped down on that. But the street class and the enthusiast class were relatively open. And then AMS brought out what was at the time and 700-800 horsepower Evo, something like that.
Yeah.
2007. I think Martin actually drove it. Damn.
And that's one of the things I said way back then. You have to have a cat on it. I'm like, fine. I can put a cat at my rear bumper and still make, 700 wheel horsepower all day in a Subaru. And it's a street class car. Take your pick.
Mike, do you want to tell the story about when we almost got into a fight with somebody, fight over a Cadillac?
Oh, my gosh. So, we were so stupid. But we were in California. We were at Auto Club, California Speedway, whatever you want to call it. We were at Auto Club. For the final event of the year, 2010.
Don't ask me, man.
10 or 9. Doesn't matter. Too long ago. Anyway, we were there. We had done a lot of events that year. We'd done pretty well. We wanted to go out to California because,
this might be my favorite event ever. It was.
It probably was. We talk about it as the pinnacle a lot. But the California guys always think they're the best, right? The West Coast guys always think they're the best. So we're we're going to go out there and try to do some stuff. And we had been... Was this the year that we'd been fighting Cobb all year? I think so. And we'd been messing with Cobb all year and Cam Brenner and his car, which is, you remember.
That was the stop tag.
No, that might have been.
That was.
Yeah, I know. I'm just saying that Cobb was the one we were messing with a lot.
Okay.
And so to put it in perspective, we were racing against Cobb and they had this rig all year and we were still running around on a U-Haul with a truck we didn't even have because we were borrowing other people's trucks and all this stuff. But we were just doing the stupid life, right? And so we got to California, and one of the cars that shows up was Stop Tech. And so Steve was there, with his sons, and his son was driving the car. And that car was nicely built. It was a good car, all that fun stuff. And so it was Evo 10, and we had our Evo 7 at the time, and we were pretty quick. And RS3s were the tire at the time, to put it in perspective. And we go, and it was we didn't make a lot of power. And the record was held by somebody who had 600. People don't actually know, but he was claiming 600-700 horsepower at the time. And so the record there was held by that guy, and he happened to be at the event.
Not competing right?
Not competing, just being drunk.
Yeah, he was an old Redline competitor.
Yeah,
and he had a bunch of records for the original Redline, when first came out. Yeah. 6 and 7.
Was this the Evo 10 guy?
No, it was an Evo 8, I think.
It wasn't even 08. Okay. And so we don't need to get into
too specific
out of it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So we're running pretty fast, and we're getting closer and closer to the record. Stop Tech's getting closer and closer to the record. And the Stop Tech car made some good power, so that wasn't
overly awkward, but our car was still pretty simple in the whole scheme of things. It wasn't too crazy or anything like that. And Dan's just driving the shit out of it, which was fantastic. And right before our last run, this dude was hanging around the pit and he came over and he starts talking shit and stuff like that. He's like, you know, your car doesn't have a cat on it. It's illegal. It's bullshit. You can't break my record like that. Like, that's bullshit. You're cheating. And we kind of just ignored him because he kind of seemed like he was drunk and we didn't really know. And like, whatever.
Yeah.
And so I was cool. Grant was cool. Everybody was cool. But I could tell Grant was starting to get a little saucy and spicy. And when Grant gets angry, he gets real angry. So he'll fuck you up. And so he just kept on pushing. He kept on getting too close to the car, all this stuff. And he wouldn't leave. So I like turned to him and I'm like, dude, just leave us alone. Like, seriously, we're not interested in beating the shit out of you right now. Just leave us alone. Like, come on. I don't even know who you are. And so I was getting pretty amped up, and we went and grabbed some of the people and we're like, hey, I don't know who this dude is, but he won't leave us alone. Later we found out who he was, of course. And it was bullshit. And he goes to the Stop Tech guys and he tells them that we're illegal. And so at the time, right, there's the put up your $1,500 if you want to talk shit. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You want to protest. And so he tells them that we're illegal. And Steve comes over and Steve's like, so-and-so told me that you guys were fucking illegal and this is bullshit and blah, 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 blah. And no problem with Steve. Steve's great. And we talked to Steve and we're like, and I'm like, at first they were like, do you want to put up the $1,500 to find out if, you know, you want to protest for real? And I'm like, we're not cheating, so I wouldn't put your money on the line. I'll take your $1,500, but we're not cheating, so it's kind of a waste. And I'm like, why did you say that? Like, what made you think that? And he's like, well, that guy told me. Say again?
Oh, we didn't have a full exhaust on our car, which confused people's brains. Right. It wasn't in the rule. We just had a cat with a downturn on it.
Yeah, a down pound. Yeah, we turned it down. Yeah,
still counts.
It just had to be a cat, right? And so Steve's like freaking out about it, and they're all talking, and like, I'm like, I'll take your $1,500, but it doesn't, you know what I mean? Like, we're not cheating or anything like that. And so they have us come over and they roll us up, and I'm like, and they're like, do you want them to pay? And I'm like, yeah. No, I don't really care.
No, they should
have said, yeah, fuck that. You should have said, absolutely.
I was like, it wasn't Steve. That's the thing. It wasn't Steve. It was this other dude. Like, if the other dude had to pay, like, absolutely. But Steve's a nice guy. Steve just got a little too competitive at the moment.
Yeah.
And so he's like, I just, and then they just rolled under there and looked under the car. They're like, yep, that's a cat. And then Steve's like, I am so sorry.
Also, having dealt with Steve back in like my FSAE days, like he always seemed like a real nice dude. Genuinely.
Yeah, yeah. It was so
and
cool.
Actually,
and so
didn't Stop Tech sell out now to Centric or somebody?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Steve's gone. He's way gone.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, good for him, but sad. I'm sure. Yeah. I hope it doesn't go the way of the rest of the aftermarket companies. But
right, exactly. And that's what sucks. We talked to Steve afterwards, and he's just like, really, really apologetic. He's like, I'm really sorry. I got caught up in it. You know, if you ever need anything, here's my personal card. Just give me a call. All this stuff. And he's like, you're going so fast. You guys are a great team, all that stuff. But like, I just got way too competitive. And so we ended up running a 146.3 something, maybe a little bit higher than that. And they ran a 147.1 or something like that. So we both broke the record, but we won that event. And like Dan said, that was like probably the biggest event we won because it was like the last lap. Dan freaking matted it down around turn one and turn two.
We had a coolant leak that,
you know. It was like 1.81 Gs on 255 RS3s on a bank. It was like, holy shit, that thing fucking hooked. Yeah, a coolant leak that I probably caused. And so we had clamped the freaking radiator shut. And it was just like, we gave it all the boost, like literally all of it. And it was just like, it was such a good event. Like, it was a great outcome for what it could have been. So that was really cool. But it was just hilarious, that whole thing. And we took pictures with Steve in the car after that and all that. And
that was definitely cool. Back when you guys were still street car, right? Street class?
That was a street class car.
Yeah.
And so,
when did you guys jump to Unlimited? Was it 14?
Unlimited? Yeah, Unlimited was when we crashed
when
the car.
When they ran into a wall, it kind of changed things.
And then, restarted.
So that was 2013 then?
2013 is when we hit
the wall. Because I was there at Rotolana when it happened. Also a tick, and that's when we... The engine didn't come out for a refresh that summer, or that winter, as it was supposed to, because... Turning Concepts had just, they're moving to the new shop, and, you know, The race car, of course, is the back burner. So, like, I have Tony take it on down. This is Tony Wiesenhahn, who drove the car. He right. and Greg, they came on down, and I met them at Road Atlanta, and we're down there for the weekend. And now they got R&R'd and snapped a crank at 8,400 RPM. So that's fun.
Yeah.
That's a fun.
At least it's better than building that engine. That wasn't the same engine, right? The engine that you guys had to build at Sebring was like...
That was before me. That was a separate one.
Right.
That was also a snap crank, but that was the newer nitride crank.
Right, that was a snap crank. I remember that because they were rebuilding it, and I walked over, and the crank snout's gone, and I'm like, what in the world are you guys doing? And they're like, dude, they're sitting there polishing fucking journals, and I'm like, I
love Clint. Clint is, funny thing is, I called Clint because he wasn't at the race, nor was Tony Barber. Neither of them were at the race that weekend. Yeah. I called Clint, and I was like, I can take Tony W's trailer and the car and bring it back with me to Virginia Beach and build an engine and put it in, because I know if it goes back to you guys, it's not going to get an engine, it's going to get parked.
Sure.
And here we are. What is it, 2024? The car's been parked since. It's just how it goes.
We've talked to them about it.
Yeah, you run a business and shit sits. And
yeah.
And the wild thing to me is, even with that car, it was only a 285 car. It didn't have a wide body. It was factory fenders, like, pulled and stretched.
Right.
Yeah. And the front fenders cut and flared to fit wide. But it was only on 285s. It was not a crazy car. And at the time, right. A7s were new. So A7s, what, C91s, I think, were the...
Yeah,
C91s and 275 were the hotness.
Yeah. And that was that era. And I still wish we'd had a chance because we got that car. See, we had a death wobble, as we called it, that was happening in the back end. It was basically when you have struts, as you guys know, but for the listeners. So struts are a load-bearing member of a car if you have McPherson strut. And what happens when you start putting a bunch of extra grip and a bunch of lateral load into it, and the shafts are not large enough for it, you start getting stiction right. in the damper. And the stiction can show up in for instance, a highly loaded coming off of apex and rolling into 600-plus pound-feet of torque on all-wheel drive car.
Power into it.
And right. It goes into a insane resonance wheel hop. Like, the GoPro would shake so badly you couldn't see anything in car. Tony, the driver... Well, he loved it. He's like, I can be in fourth gear and come off of, like, hog's pen and just, like, I'm blasting all four tires off in fourth gear. He's like, this is amazing.
Right.
He was happy. But, the death wobble coming off where you're trying to have traction, you're at the point of traction limit, and it starts getting that grip, loss of grip, and it starts wheel hopping. It would shake so violently, his vision would go blurry. And that scared him.
Dear God.
Like, when your human eyeballs can't deal with the vibration, which we have this amazing thing in us that most mammals don't have. I don't think any other mammal actually has it, if I recall. But I'm not a biologist, so don't quote me on it. But yeah, the stabilization we have with our balls, and it vibrated so badly he couldn't keep up with it. So we started sorting that out, went to some new struts. We were shaking them down like Oktoberfest. This NASA Mid-Atlantic has here, so we're at a VIR in October. And we're literally just going out and have cameras on it and some instrumentation trying to figure it out and like upset it in some corners and kind of slow down to the next corner and that sort of thing. Like, he's not out there killing it. We're on low boost for like 22 pounds. And our Harry's lap timer says we have a lap in it of a minute 52 at VIR on low boost. Like, we're only on 22 pounds of boost. And I saw that, and it was really, really exciting, because I'm like, that's a lot of potential. We also grenaded fourth gear that day, so we didn't get to turn it up and go full tilt. And then we brought it out to Atlanta, and it parked.
What time, you're saying?
152. It was like a 152.2, if I recall, is what Harry's lap timer said. We officially ran a 154.3, but again... Tony was kind of picking and choosing corners.
How much power is that on low boost? Low boost doesn't mean anything to me.
Yeah, it was 22 PSI and a 35R. Mid-5s, maybe?
Mid-550.
Yeah, low.
575.
Yeah,
how efficient?
Much.
How? What was the V on it?
I don't recall. This is a long while ago. Yeah, so it on kill was 740-ish at like 32 pounds, 34 pounds.
Yeah, 33.
Yeah, 34 yeah, pounds, yeah. I think it was like 750. So
yeah, so that had a little higher V than we did.
Yeah.
With the Evo, because we were running 32 pounds at, well, I guess pretty close. 32 pounds at 720. Yeah, so we were pretty close. Not bad. Yeah, 32 pounds at 720. So yeah, V was pretty close to each other.
Yeah.
I assume, and that was on what fuel?
It might have been E98, if I recall, at the time.
Ignite then?
It was Ignite.
Okay, yeah. So yeah, that makes sense then, because we had right around those same numbers. So like ours at 24 pounds is 550, 575. So it's right around the same numbers.
Same kind of territory.
Yeah, 15 horsepower per pound, basically. 15.
Yeah, and it was an EJ25, which was not my vote for the bottom end, but it's what they had at the time. So it was still in there. So yeah, I did cams and take an exhaust manifold for it and some other power side changes. But then a lot of it was aero stuff. much to your chagrin. The rear radiator, yeah. That was a fun one. Where you know, when people look at it in the pits. So I pulled two half NACA ducts off the floor, and we ducted it up through the back seat area, and the radiator was in the trunk. So we were like, I think we were probably the first in the U.S. to run the rear radiator. I think GST, Mike might have been running them too at that point in time.
Yeah, GST was the first one, because he had it in 2007.
Was Mike that early with the rear? I don't think it was that early. I think it was 2010, 2011, somewhere in there. Mike's had it a long time, but yeah.
When they were at Auto Club, they didn't have the rear radiator. That was the year we met Jeff Westfall.
That's right. So then it would have to be 10 because he put the fucking trash cans on it in 10.
Yeah. I thought the trash cans was Element Tune Phil.
Yeah.
Phil did that.
Phil did trash cans. Anyway, Mike probably did too. So anyway, I remember there had been a GC in the Time Attack series in the UK that was running back in like 2008 or 9. It was a blue GC that had them. And I was like, that's kind of smart. You know, how would I implement this better? So I went half NACAs off the floor, which, yes, hurts the diffuser, but you're also using the radiator to fill your backlight angle. So for me, it was kind of a trade-off in drag. Yeah. We didn't need the downforce.
It's a loss in downforce. It's a gainer in drag.
We also want a big downforce car either. Like, the Turning Concepts car ran very little aero altogether.
Right, comparatively.
It was a rocket. Yeah. The whole thing was reduce drag and go fast.
Yeah. And realistically, if you look at our car and you look at our drag coefficients and stuff like that, like I calculated, like our car isn't that draggy. It might look like it's got a lot to it, whatever, but it's not. We don't have canards. We don't have, you know, crazy end plates. We don't have anything that really adds a ton of drag. We don't have any extra garbage on the car to really add a lot of drag.
Dive plates are terrible. They really are.
Yeah. And that's why you have to do them well for it to work. And that's what people just do them because they're like, I'll make more power. And I'm like, the second you make more power, you put stress on everything.
Yeah.
And then that's why you don't race. Like if you can do a 500-600-700 horsepower car that lives all day long, but now you've made it so draggy that you have to make it 1,000 horsepower. Like, yes, aero is the king.
Welcome to Formula One.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But aero is king. Yeah, I get it. But us collectively in the Time Attack world, generally, unless you're super high up in Australia, don't have the ability to keep the car together, right? And so, like, Ferris is pretty okay to keep the car together.
No one wants to spend the money.
That's what I'm saying.
So that's part of ability, silly.
Yeah, that's the same thing. Resources.
That's a fucking resource.
Jesus Christ. Anyway, I want to go back just a tiny bit.
$4,000 wheels on it instead of some NK NTO3s.
Okay, relax. Relax.
Calm down. We never did that. Anyway, I want to go back just a slight bit. Yeah. Just a slight bit to where you were talking about that hop you were talking about. With the suspension, you know, the McPherson strut.
The depth wobble, because,
yeah, so for our Evo people, for our Subaru people, which is a lot of you people, and anybody, like, right, so the distinction factor is two things, right? He said that the shaft size isn't large enough. So what happens is, obviously, if you have it as part of your stressed member, right, that's holding almost all your lateral load at your top point, right? So you have your bottom, you know, arms, whatever it be, you got parallel arms on the Subaru, you got a lower control arm, you got a trailing arm, you got all this other stuff on an Evo, but you have a lot of, you know, on an Evo, it's multi-link. On a strut car, you've got all that load going through that shaft. And when you go through that shaft, and like the front of an Evo, like it literally bends the shaft a little bit, and it doesn't make it, it doesn't bend it permanently. It elastically deforms that shaft a little bit, and then it doesn't make it through the seal. So the seal gets a little tight, and then when the load gets high enough, it pops. And then it does it again, and it does it again, does it again. And so the best thing we've found to deal with that is either you strengthen the whole system, which is actually something we worked with Fortune Auto on to strengthen their shafts. Strong shafts. And or the other option is to literally turn up rebound so far that it never moves once it's on the floor. But like when you accelerate, especially in an all-wheel drive car, or even if you don't, even if it's like a normal car, right, the transitions all that weight to the rear. So you're asking that suspension in the back to do so much. You're asking that shock to fundamentally hold on. And generally, the outside is loaded more than anything else. So you're asking that outside shock to handle the lateral load. Then it gets more heavily loaded when you transition power to the rear. And now you're asking it to compensate for that load, which is more lateral load. And then now you've got a transitional load where you're trying to accelerate out. So now you're asking it to do all of those things all at once. And so you've turned your shock into kind of a banana at that point.
Yeah.
And it'll come back most of the time.
And it's almost like a hysteresis.
Until it breaks.
And it's almost like a hysteresis.
It is.
You have stiction, right? And once the stiction gives, it pops really hard, so it unloads. and it comes back and gets back to where it is, and this is happening super fast. And if it's loaded again, sticks and pops in and loads, and that's what makes it have that wobble, that really high resonance that was making, you know, Tony's eyes blur. Is that you have this thing where it shocks so fast, where it's doing this faster than you could possibly fathom or see. It looks like a blur on camera, unless you have like a high-speed camera, which we did not have. We just had GoPros and wheel wells and attached to things. But yeah, the other thing is there's another way to get around it is through design, which is an inverted strut design. Because an inverted strut design essentially then flips the strut upside down. So now what is normally the wide part of your shocks, you know, the strut's body, essentially becomes the upper portion. So that shaft diameter becomes the entire body, and it's super robust. And then the outer part...
And that's what rally
cars use. Well, even STIs come that way from the factory. But I'm blown away that more people in the aftermarket doing struts don't do it. I mean, there is a couple things, right? You can go higher.
There are some downsides.
We'll do it.
There's some downsides because a lot of the valving characteristics for so if you think about how a valve is made in the aftermarket, most of the valving systems that they have available to them are based on a very common similar valve, right? For a standard shock design.
Right.
And so if you go inverted, now you have a different valve technically. And so a lot of them don't have like a great setup for those types of valves.
It's not that you haven't. Your valve doesn't change. Your compression, so your compression direction. Your rebound, so your rebound direction. You have some additional. You have some additional drag from the additional O-ring sealing the outside of what is your strut.
The diameter. Yep.
No, diameters can be the same. You can change. You can grow.
No. I'm saying the diameter of the actual shot, because the shaft is so much larger, you do have more stiction based on that. Right. Based on that diameter, so you're actually adhering, if you will, to the shaft. At more places, there's more area.
Well, that's what I was saying. You have the additional drag, the additional stiction, friction, whatever you call it, of the O-ring sealing to what it would be the outside of your strut body. So that's the only real additional friction you have from it. You can do a shaft seal, you can do a wiper, you can do sealed. So having worked at JRI, there are all kinds of ways around it that you can do to help slick it up a bit. But
And then you have a weight difference, right? So that's the other side of it. The weight is switched, if you will. Because now you're inverted comparatively, and so that's helpful. So that can be helpful in a lot of ways. And so there are ways to get around it for sure, but, you know.
By weight, you mean just weight of the system total, or are you talking sprung on sprung and how you split half this, half that?
You are
this way you're going with the weight comment, just curious.
Unsprung and sprung weights, yes. But that's a good clarification right there. It's technically not a huge amount, but it does have an effect on how the shock handles the, you know, handles the oscillations and things like that. So it's something to keep in mind.
I personally take the trade-off of my shock does its job. I'll take the extra bit of weight.
Once you get to that level of load, obviously you want it to do its job. But I think it's interesting if you don't know what an inverted shock looks like, go look up an inverted shock. It's pretty common in rally because obviously there's lateral loads in terms of hitting objects or digging into dirt. It's pretty important that you don't break a shock shaft. So.
Yep.
So they generally do that.
I don't believe
because
you.
They don't. Yeah.
Say so they generally say go look at a Reiger. Reiger's R-E-I-G-E-R. What, Australia or New Zealand fire call? I think they're owned by Olin's now. But yeah, they're a good example of high end rally shocks. We're gonna go look at some of those. But just look up inverted strut, and you'll see probably stock STI stuff come up. They're inverted from the factory, but.
And the front Bilstein option. So on any of the Evo MRs in the U.S., the front one is inverted.
Okay.
Versus a regular one.
Because the rear, you guys, it's what, just a shock fire call, right?
Yeah, correct.
It's a multi-link.
So it's been a while since I had my Evo 8, but yeah.
That's all right. It's not important. They have other problems. They also have this oscillation effect in the rear, but it's not the same. They start to oscillate really badly under load. But in the front, like I said, for the Evo, since we have a strut car, it's not inverted. We've talked about inverted before. All that stuff. It's not inverted. I work with Fortune to look at what options were available in terms of geometry, in terms of material, in terms of all these things to increase their shock shaft bending, right? To decrease the bending under load, right? So to increase the strength. And so we worked on that as well. So it's nice because stuff like that, people don't know, you know, it never comes up because people are like, oh, it's the same Taiwanese garbage that everybody else has. And I'm like, it's not.
Yeah. Well, so
I know that because I actually worked on it. So
yeah. I laugh. So I'm from Virginia.
And they're right next to
Navy brat. I'm originally from Hawaii, but you know, that doesn't count. Virginia's home. It's where I grew up. It's where I went to the university. It's where I, you know, cut my teeth on a lot of stuff.
Right.
And yeah, like I feel like Fortunato really took off after I left and moved to North Carolina. And yeah, they're just up the road. So I was Virginia Beach. They're just up the road in Richmond. Like I've never dealt with them or worked with them, but it looks like they're really putting their stuff together.
But, and that's the thing. They are. And they order parts, but they make custom parts. Like they now they're making all the pistons in house. They're making all their valves. All their valves are in house. Like
I know what you meant.
People think it. Yeah. Sorry. I mean, it's got to make it clear for everybody else. But like, yeah, they might grab some, you know, bodies, right? Collars, sleeves, stuff like that, off the shelf parts. That lots of people do that. Lots of people buy seals off the shelf. It's fine. Like you can buy some of those things, but if the good part, bodies, right, the important part,
bodies are a pretty important part. Straightness, circularity, it's a big deal.
I'm not saying that's not true, but those bodies work. I'm not saying that they're the best bodies, but like I can go buy Penske parts right now. Mm-hmm. Penske doesn't necessarily make all their parts. I can go buy all of their parts from somebody.
Yep.
And so the point I'm saying is that people instantly think because their parts are available somewhere or they look like some other part that's available somewhere, that it means that it's garbage. And I'm like, that's not exactly how it works. Yeah, I can understand like,
Fortunato could be calling up JRI and just buying their bodies or calling up Penske and buying their bodies. And yeah, you're using a part that's off the shelf. And if you're, particularly being on the manufacturing side, if you're, you know, volumes are low enough that you're not going to, you know, be running a mass number,
it's probably cheaper
to buy it from somebody else until you get to the point where it goes, all right, we're now finally at the point where we're ordering these, you know, 5,000 at a time. Let's set up our own manufacturing line and get all this done. Yeah. And particularly shock shafts. I mean, the stuff we were doing for like the LMP2 cars and stuff at JRI, that it was ridiculous. Between the coatings and the stainless grinding, after coatings and heat treats, to then make them background, to then do this coating again, to do a final stainless grind on the thing, to have it done to this point, the surface finishes this and circularity and rounded blade, and everything on it's just completely. And it's amazing. It's insane how far down a rabbit hole you can go in shock stuff.
I worked on that exact same thing with Fortune. From a much, much lower extent, right? Because they didn't have a ton of money. I was looking at options. I was talking to manufacturer for them, stuff like that, just to see what we could do to improve their strength. Like, where can we improve iteratively for not a ridiculous amount of cost? And so they did a lot of, they made a lot of improvements. Now, most people would look at that shaft and they wouldn't know that it's any different than, you know, let's say another shaft from another shock. But there are definitely some things on their shafts that are different, because there are improvements that were made, like I said, when we worked on it. And so it's things like that it's hard. Like you said, the center grind, the actual plating, when it's ground, how it's ground, the thickness of the plating, all these things are super important if you want to build something that's strong and has very low friction, things like that. And it's just people that, you know, you can't tell necessarily from the outside without really inspecting the parts.
Yeah.
And so it's an important factor here that I think needs to be understood a little bit better. Anyway, we explained that whole thing. So we talked about a little bit how rules are stupid. And I wanted to say the GTA side, they don't change rules a lot, but then they changed the rule to try to commonize a little bit with world time tech so that, you know, there'd be some parity there. If some of the Australians want to come here, we want to go there. Obviously, that hasn't happened a ton, but it's happened, right? There's more Americans went last year than ever before, so that's great. We obviously
have. I mean, how many was that? Like 3?
5?
Yeah, so what the fuck? Like, why does that even matter? That doesn't make sense to me.
It's just, I mean, it's an attempt, and I don't mind that attempt. That's fine.
There was years back, I guess not that many years back, talk of World Time Attack creating an event in the U.S.
And so parody that out. Yeah,
if they're gonna try and they'd
want to bring
COVID hit
way back when before SLB was at COTA. Yeah, they'd want to have it set up so they could bring cars to California, and so WTAC would come to California. GTA would go to Australia. You'd have, you know, top cars from each class sort of thing. Now, why does it matter? Why does it not matter? At the same time, you have 5 cars going, but there's practically zero parity between rule books. It's pretty awesome that 5 people went out of their way to make a car that could fit WTAC rules at a handicap of being in a U.S. rule book. So I'll say that's actually pretty notable.
Yeah. I mean,
I don't think it's notable enough to change the whole rule set for when it seems like there's only, one car that came over here?
It wasn't a whole change, but what it was what they allowed for, right, was functionally almost a front half and a back half, because they allowed the floor pan rule stayed. You get what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the big change. And for us, it was like, we're not even close to that, so it's whatever. But if you really wanted to take advantage of the World Time Attack rules or GTA rules as they sit now, still nobody has done it.
Yeah.
Ferris would be the closest to trying to do it. Will would be maybe a little.
And like, from what I know, Ferris's car is even crazy in terms of like what you could do to develop a car. I mean, yes, he's got aero and a bunch of lightweight stuff, and he's got great power, but like, his chassis still largely just a C6.
Correct, I mean, that's the same thing. I mean, that's the same thing with anybody in the U.S. The U.S. time tech cars are not overly developed.
Yeah.
Because they're not, there's just not enough
I would say our money. Our cars are still closer to the traditional Japanese time attack than, say, WTAC is. But
Correct.
Don't get Mike started with that.
They almost, you know, spirit of time attack.
Hold on. No. We got to get Nads on here for that. Yeah. Someone grab a PBR. We're talking to Nads. Yeah.
But the, and that does, it's whatever. Like, that's fine. But we, but, you know, that's the whole thing. It's like, if you look at how much some of the, like, if you look at how much some of those world time attack cars cost, I'm like,
no shot.
Like, that's like, 10 times the cost of my maybe 20 in some cases.
You know where I want to go with the project. Like, if I win the lottery.
I know. And I don't even think your idea is that is too crazy. I don't even think that's too crazy. But no, again, it, you know, the less money, the more time and really having good people involved. I mean, look at the RP team. Look at, you know, look at all the team for Hammerhead. Look at all, well, not Hammerhead anymore, but look at all the team.
What happened to Hammerhead? Like,
it's your name.
They don't call it. They changed their name because it's not a Hammerhead anymore.
Well, yeah,
now it's got Infinity Wings and all that stuff.
Yeah,
yeah. And so MCA sold it, it's whoever, I forgot who owned it this year.
But, someone else bought the MCA car. I didn't realize they sold it.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
they sold it. And so, but that's the thing. Like, MCA put so much time and energy into that car. You know, obviously RP put so much time and energy into that car, and they have this whole team building things out, right? They've got an engine specialist. They got a suspension specialist. They got a, you know, really good fabricators and cage guys and all this stuff. They got a fucking carbon people.
The RP car is pretty silly. It makes Nemo almost. Right. It makes Nemo, like, people protest the Nemo thing for a couple of small things that really did not make a world of difference. Right?
Yeah. I mean, so Nemo was whatever. Yeah. I don't care about Nemo. Yeah.
And so Nemo got this, like, these rules, this is so out of the spirit of shit. This, and then you get the RP.
But it was the.
And you got the RP car that shows up with a billet, like, 4-liter Porsche inline four. Fantastic work. Yeah, love the work that's been done. Not knocking any of that, but it's almost like this is totally otherworld. Like,
we hung out with. Yeah. He came to PRI a couple years ago. I don't know if he still comes, but.
The Elmer dude?
Elmer.
Yeah, Elmer.
We talked. He's a nice guy. I really like him. But he's like, he had the Thor. He had a Thor engine there, or like a head for it or something. I can't remember. But he was at PRI, and we were hanging out with him a little bit. And we were just talking about, like, he's like, I'm like, how much power has it made so far? And he's like, I don't know, like 1,200. I'm like, how much power can it make? He's like, it'll make like 3,000. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah, yeah, basically. And meanwhile, like, you know, I'm talking about taking the junkyard Ford engine for giggles for nostalgia of the chassis I want to run. And like that sort of thing, you're going, hold on, what? I'm taking literally a $3,000 used engine from an F-150 and shoving it to something, build it. Yeah, anyway.
Yeah,
it's a very different way of approaching it. We're looking at transaxles from IndyCars on eBay for, you know, $8,000. Like, it's a whole other world. But yeah.
And that's what I'm saying. Like, even Tilton, like, we were talking to Tilton for a while about what they did for their engine, right? So we talked to them. You know, they were all really nice about it, and they were trying to tell us how, you know, they build it. They were super nice about it because they didn't have to, right? But we were like, yeah, we haven't had gasket problems. We were asking about this, asking about that. They were super cool. They told us exactly what happened, how they build it, you know, who's building it, all that stuff. And you know, because they're making a little more power than us, and they were on nitrous, and they were just like, yeah, it won't last forever, you know, but it'll last a little bit longer. And I'm like, okay, that's nice. We don't. What do we do if we don't have money to replace engines? And he's like, that's a tough one.
That's a tough one, huh? You can go fuck yourself is what you could do.
Yeah, like, do you like fishing and don't get too deep because that shit'll get expensive too, right? Or how about cocaine? Anyway, that's it. It's just rough. Nobody, you know, I'm trying to think, like, the most expensive. What's the most expensive car in the US? I mean, it got to be. I think the Life GTR is probably the most expensive, just by virtue of all the carbon fiber on it. Who else would be expensive? Who else would be expensive?
Unlimited class, or I mean, that McLaren.
Yeah, like McLaren from last year.
Jason Kanakri, 720, just by initial vehicle cost. The
McLaren race car thing.
Yeah. But that's a hard one, because I don't know if I'd call that time attack car, right? Like, that's not exactly a time attack.
What the fuck was it? I don't know.
What's a McLaren?
It was like a 720S GT3.
Yeah, I'll say, was it just a GT3 car? just.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, GT, the street, just. GT3 car.
Yeah, you can buy a McLaren GT3. There's McLaren GT3 car for sale here in Mooresville. It's like $265.
Why are you saying that like we can afford it?
No, I'm not saying like you can afford it. I'm saying like here's a number of, a ballpark of what you can realistically, like GT3 cup car, same sort of thing. You're talking $200,000 to $300,000, depending on generation, year, that sort of shit. So yeah, that's kind of that price range. And likewise, I mentioned something like a brand new 720S, because that's in the same price range. So that's why I thought you were talking about Jason. But, talking more of the Spirit.
Watch it.
What? The Spirit?
Don't say Spirit. Stop saying Spirit.
I say.
You're a strike two.
You can't see my air quotes when I'm saying Spirit. Every time I say this, Spirit.
That's all right.
I go by robots. I like to poke holes in robots. It's what I do for a living.
I feel it, though. But no, I don't mean it. It is. Yeah, it's much more Japanese time attack. I mean, for sure. Most U.S., our car, all that stuff, much more Japanese time attack. Just like you start with a car and you do what you can from that car, right? The other side of it, world time attack is much more like, hey, here's a silhouette and we're going to make it slightly mimic that silhouette.
Yeah, think about it. I'm curious how much Jackie Ding's Super would have cost if you bought it, if everybody paid outright, no sponsors, no nothing, just bought it. All the Varus kit, all the parts, all the AMS stuff, the brand new
pretty
car.
Pretty expensive.
About 110, 120.
I was thinking closer to 150, but okay.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Obviously, nobody knows all the development, but I wouldn't think that'd be out of the ballpark.
I mean,
I'm not saying development costs. I'm saying this stuff's been done. I can call up the suppliers.
I understand.
Yeah, I'm buying a new Supra. I want to buy aero kit from you, powertrain from you.
Yeah, AMS shit ain't cheap. Yeah. But he's got a lot of AMS stuff on there and it ain't cheap. So he's got a lot of Varus stuff on there and it ain't cheap, right? Like there's a...
Yeah, and I'm not saying the parts aren't worth it. Like it's definitely quality engineered good stuff, you know, but like, yeah, it's just not cheap to have a car done at that level, at that cost, at that everything else.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we've always, you know, half prided ourselves on being able to compete with much more expensive things, which is generally true. It just sucks. Like, there's a lot of things we'd do different if we could. Like, we spent how long trying to make a stock trans work, right? We ran a 42 at Buttonwillow with a stock trans. A stock's a relative term, but, you know, stock trans.
Along the same sort of thing, though. I find it kind of annoyingly, let's say, whack. That rules, for instance, won't allow you to do things.
Whack?
Yeah, it's whack.
Whack.
If you have the ability or skills to do something to a car to make it go faster, you cannot within a given rule. Whereas if you have, for instance, $60,000 or $100,000 to buy a car that can do it better, that does it from the factory, but you're not allowed to do it because that car does it from the factory, but yours doesn't, you're not allowed to do it. For instance, DCT or take a, you know, flat bottom under tray, or taking things that the car comes with, you can have it and run it. But if your car didn't come with it, heaven forbid you spend that $100 on some lumen light to give yourself an under tray, because that's not allowed by the rules. But that other car in the rules can have.
GTRs were banned from most classes.
Well, GTRs were banned from like GTA stuff, but you know, take an A90 Supra, take a Lotus Elise, take all kinds of stuff, right? Like it's
Caymans.
Yeah, Caymans. You put a PDK in it. Oh, if you're a PDK car, then you're great because you can upgrade it. But if you're a manual, you can't swap back to an auto because we're stupid and have rules by your VIN number, right? Yeah, it's some of the dumbest rules I've ever heard in my life. But
so, I think it's important though that we go back slightly, and if you don't know Micaiah, why do we always say it wrong?
I'm like Micaiah, what the fuck is he talking about?
Who's this McKenzie?
I always want to call you Micaiah. I don't know why. I always want to call you Micaiah. Can we just change your name so it's easier for me? Because
It's really easy. Say your own name and then pause. Like, Mike, what was I going to say?
It is. And I still, like, it's been 14 years, and you can ask Devin. I say it wrong every time.
Mm-hmm, it's true.
Every time. Like, why am I so
dumb? Because
we
met on the internet before we met in person. That's probably what it was.
Yeah. No, it's, my brain's, I mean,
Or we met the track, and you're like, I don't know, it's one of 10,000 names I get this week, and you're like, you can't remember names anyway.
Yeah. But that's the important part here is that we need to have a giveaway. I think that's important. Oh, and giveaway. I think the giveaway I think the giveaway should be like, if you don't know Micaiah, right? You can't cheat. If you don't know Micaiah, you're gonna get to guess his age just by his use of the word whack. And I think that's important.
Well, that is fun. How old do you think I am based off of saying whack?
Because that's whack. That's very whack. And so we can do that. Maybe we'll do that. We'll see. We'll announce it at the end if that's true. Devin will say. He's going to decide because he's the, you know, whatever, the arbiter, right? What director? Director.
The arbiter. Cool. All right, I like that.
the arbiter of cool. So yeah, he'll figure out that portion of it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, anyway, yeah, all the rules are stupid. That's, I mean, every racer ever, right? It's hard. And so I get some of them. I don't get other ones, but it's like, for me, it's been like, I just don't care anymore. It's been so long. I'm just like, I'm gonna bend these and see what happens.
Apparently the word whack was first used in Old English in 1721.
You're not that old though. Are you a vampire?
No, definitely not.
Impressive.
Yeah. I mean, if you are, that's okay. It's okay.
No, not a vampire.
A ginger vampire would be fucking make sense, honestly. Holy shit.
He said you have no soul.
I just harbor all the souls, yeah.
All the things are starting to come up. Oh my gosh, it's all coming together. This is, oh God, this is making a lot of sense. Anyway.
Solving real problems here.
Yeah, so figuring out the real things. So rules, what else do we want to talk about?
Oh goodness, you tell me.
Well, I wanted to
Devin
know.
Devin always complains about bad ideas. Oh, Dan, you did have a specific thing. Go ahead.
Dan wanted to actually talk about engineering as well a little bit. So let's let Dan go for it.
Well, I was saying to the guys before we were recording that we had a history of getting engines built and them all sucking terribly. And as an engine engineer, what are like your tips and tricks to what are the first steps you need to be taking in order to get a well-built engine so you're not wasting money?
So things I'll differentiate from in terms of building for, say, time attack, in particular, you know, road course type use. It is far more demanding than drag racing building in terms of thermal management. So that affects your tolerances and all kinds of other things.
Drag racing is so much harder.
Drag racing is very short use, very hard abuse, but you take a drag race engine builder and say, hey, I want you to build this engine to run 25 hours of Thunder Hill. They're going to have a steep learning curve. Now, the same principles are there, but the general experience of what is there and knowing how to build it is what is missing. I'm not saying one couldn't get to the other or vice versa. A road race guy couldn't get to doing drag stuff, but it's the environment they've been working in and what those engines have to do. And I say this in particular because most people that are doing this, they have not engineered the parts. They have not designed the parts. They have not done all the FEA, you know, the thermal expansion piston wall and, you know, ring gaps and bearing clearances for running at, you know, elevated oil temperatures and, you know, what the effective viscosity of your oil is at that temperature for that amount of time at that power, yada, yada, yada. So this, a lot of engine building at this level is learned. So it's not that someone can just go turnkey and say, hey, these are the pistons, these are the rods. I've never done these before, but it's going to be the winning setup. And here's your rod bearing clearance, the mains, and this should be good to go. Send it. That's just not how it works. Now, a connecting rod in that regard has a pretty easy life in terms of it's, you can shotgun a connecting rod, have a big beefy connecting rod, and it'll survive and it'll be fine. It'll hurt your lap times for sure. Indefinitely, without a doubt, your acceleration rates, everything else will be slower because you got a bigger rod. You know, big, fat, chunky rod that you're spinning around, slinging. But if you're a spinning rod, you have bigger issues. That's a whole other thing. Don't go there. But pistons are in particularly really the hard part to get dialed down. Piston wall clearances, the profile of the piston itself, which if you're buying something off the shelf, you have no control over. You can start working with, if you're starting to develop a real program, start working with a piston manufacturer that you like, that's been good, that has a good relationship, good customer service, and you can start dialing that in with the needs of what you have. And particularly if you take an engine apart before you blow it up, it's a good way to start with it, and you see the wear patterns and how things are going, and you can read your rings and all kinds of other stuff, and it'll tell you a story of what's going on. And then you can do an iteration and do another iteration and another iteration to get you where you want to get. If you actually have, you know, infinite bucks, like a real race program, it's, you know, infinite in quotes, you actually design the thing from the out start with a bunch of simulation, and you kind of know where you are. And like we talked about last time, you go through all the things of, you kind of know what your thermal, you know, I'll say thermal capacities of things and your heat rejection of certain components are going to be. So you at least have an idea of where you're starting, and then you have fewer iterations to get to where you want to be.
Quick note. I just want to give you more of a sandbox. We're just talk about is just our audience, so mostly poor people. So
And so what happens is, so if you're really doing a race program, work with a builder who does what you want to do. If you want to go drag racing, go with a drag race engine builder. who's done a bunch of, you know, your particular car, your make, your model, that engine, that sort of thing. Deal with them. If you have someone, or if you're going road racing, which, or time attack, which I'm assuming a lot of the guys here are doing, find a builder who actually does that. Don't go to the guy who builds, like, for instance, if you wanted to go road racing, I wouldn't turn to Buescher and be like, hey, build me a Ford G63, although that's owned by somebody else, and I think Dave's bought it back. Now, anyway, outside of the drama, they do drag cars. I wouldn't go to Buescher to build me a time attack car, unless you're doing, like, a one-lap wonder.
So,
end of story.
Let me, I'm going to interject in real quick, too. So, let's say you've got, we're talking Evos here, and you have a Ford G63 engine. Is it better to go to someone who's experienced in, if you want to go road racing, is it better to find someone who's experienced in road racing versus someone who's experienced with the 4G?
For the build itself?
Yeah.
Is the plan to take it and do like a one shot, I want to build it once and never have to deal with it ever again? Or is this like a realization of, I know it's going to be a program, I'm going to have it this year, we'll take it down, do a teardown and inspection. Everything might be good. It might just be a refresh. Put it back together and see how it does the next year sort of thing. Or take notes from it and be like, hey, we use this JE piston for a call up and here's some pictures. Here's what we have. We'd like to get something a bit better. We'd like to improve on it. Like, kind of which way are you going with this? This is like developing a program.
Not to take it apart after 1 year.
Okay. 2 years.
Let's say it survives 2 to 3 years.
Short-circuiting
his brain.
I bet you're not short-circuiting my brain.
Like, what the? It, well, what do you mean you're not going to take it out every year?
It all comes down to the level of development you want to do.
You idiot.
Stupid.
So yeah, if you're a regular Joe Blow, you want to buy some pistons rods, slap something together and go run it, leave the power down and go run it. Like, that's the reality of it. Once you start turning the wick up, you don't know what you have. Unless your builder's done it a bunch, your builder doesn't know what you have. It's a best guess off of experience.
Sure.
Unless they've built numerous engines like this before, it's a best guess. If they've built these engines before but have never had it in this use case, it's, again, a best guess.
Sure. Now, along the same lines, so let's say you're like, okay, we understand this is going to be a program. We're going to take our best guess at the first with the experience. We're going to go, we'll just stick in the road race world. So we'll go with a road race engine builder, explain what we're going to do, you know, rely on their experience. We've got a 4G63, which ran 10W30 from the factory. What the hell oil do you put in it? What viscosity?
That's going to depend on your, well, operating temperature that you have on track, realistically. Okay. I'd assume you'd come into this with some at least inherent data. Again, if you're guessing at this blind, like, I don't know. I don't have an oil temp gauge. I don't log it. I don't know how hot it gets. Well, that's not going to help anybody. No one knows.
Sure. So if it's like, for us, our oil temperatures are stable around 180, 190, something like that. So
what?
With... Yeah, mm-hmm.
Is that good?
Or bad?
What, your
oil's
what
that
is the okay.
Cold? All right, yeah, wow. All right.
So tell us the bad side about
yeah.
Being that cold.
Yeah, sure.
Well, this
the Cinestoke value doesn't change very much between 190.
He sounds very disappointed. I want to hear his opinion.
I'm not disappointed. I'm actually quite shocked your oil's that cold. Just end of story.
Oh boy.
I'm more used to like 220s, 240s in a Subaru. Or, you know, the race world, we're pushing up to, you know, like 300 degrees, 150°C, that sort of range, for obvious reasons of reduced cooling.
Yeah,
and
then you have you have polymetric breakdown so quickly at those temperatures.
Well, you kind of skirt that edge, and that becomes the thing.
Two what? So a full synthetic group 4 base stock, right? Any group 4 base stock, for the most part, even with ad packs. You know, if you have good ad packs, fine, whatever. Anyway, you have polymetric breakdown at like 270.
Breakdown at 270. I'm also talking like specific race oils you develop with specific people. So I'm not saying any of us are touching.
Again, we are poor. We don't have these options.
That's why I also said in my race job, I'm used to, you know, we're pushing 300.
Shut it. No, it's
this is a fun view, a foyer, if you will, into like what race cars do versus what we can afford off the shelf at Walmart.
This is fun for you. Making me feel worse. This is fun for you. I get it.
The thing is, like, you can run, right? So you can run, right? You can run an oil like that. So, like, one of the big things, right? So, oh, God, we always get back to oil. This is stupid.
It's always oil. Anyway. What's the, oh gosh, what's his name? Dane, whatever his name is, the comedian from like the late 2000s.
Cook?
Dane Cook?
Dane Cook, yeah, where he had the most oil is my blood. They're doing the car alarm sound.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I, whenever yeah. someone brings up oil for an engine, that's just what goes in my head.
Oh God, yeah. That's terrible.
It's, so it's, it is special. Terrible.
I don't know why I bought it.
But back, like, what, anyway. What can our users, like our users, our listeners,
users?
Yeah, what, how can they use the information based on their oil temps? Like, if they've got a built engine and their oil temps are relatively low, what should they do? If they're relatively high,
oil temps being low aren't bad. I was just surprised that you guys are actually that low. I'm assuming you guys have quite a massive cooler system.
Nope. We took it off because it was it wouldn't get above 160, so we took it off.
We have a ton of capacity because of the dry sump. Yeah, but
yeah. Oh, well, how big's your dry sump?
Hey, it's not crazy.
And what temp is it going on track at?
Well, we let it warm up, so it goes on track at around 160.
And it basically just stays at 160?
It barely
It'll get up to 190, yeah. Like, yeah, barely, and then it will come back down.
You guys are, like, quite cool. All right,
but,
yeah, anyway.
But that's also because our cooling system works. And so the oil would definitely go up higher, but our cooling system, if we literally had to start blocking off some of the inlets and the doors because it's cooling too much. And so,
are you an air oil heat exchanger or?
No, we have no heat exchanger for the
We have no oil cooler, period. Just the radiator, just the normal radiator cooling system is so efficient because it's designed well.
It took 10 years.
170.
Oh, yeah. Well, that explains, why are you so cold?
Because it cools too easily now, and so we've had to block it off to get the temps to come up.
Yeah, run a smaller radiator and run it hotter and reject more heat. Oh, and have
so
less
easy.
Drag. Oh my god.
Re-engineer every
not.
Fucking
come
thing.
Come on,
we are not touching that radiator.
All right, fine. Then just make more power.
This is the first time they got it to stay cool.
We're gonna.
They're not touching it. Trust me.
What we did is we just close off the openings.
Oh goodness.
So we just close off.
All right. So you're still reducing your drag, right? So.
Like, there's not nearly as much. Yeah, there's not nearly.
He's so disappointed.
No, it's just. All right. Yeah, that's just extra weight. Anyway.
Yes, it is extra weight. Yeah, I don't. It's not.
You guys are really cool. So the part that gets really tricky with oils, particularly in today's market, particularly with synthetics, is how high of a shear you can have on lightweight oils now. And the fact, some of the properties you're getting, like 0W40, like Mobil 1, you'll get off the shelf. It's downright impressive. Like, you can get some wild stuff at your local Walmart that you could put on a race car and go drive.
That's what we do.
Welcome
to the world.
And you got all these guys who are like, it's got to be Motul 300V, this and that. I'm like, dude, like, really, go. Like, you don't have to. This is not knocking Motul. They make great stuff. But at the same you can just go grab a $23 gallon of oil at Walmart and be just fine.
So there's your... there's our secret. We use standard Mobil 1.
Yeah.
Yeah, 1030.
Yeah, we did buy slightly better Mobil 1. We bought the racing version, but we normally just use Mobil 1 off the shelf because like I said, I did oil analysis and everything, and if you look at it, it's like...
I call it the racing just adds higher zinc pack.
Zinc and phosphorus, but you can't have too much of it because there's a limitation now, right? And so that's why people used to use the Delvac, because like Delvac and...
what are you saying?
The Rotellas, because for diesel world.
Country
world,
boy.
Yeah.
Yep. Because I put it in my tractor and I put it in my race car.
Got some twang on that one there.
Yeah, exactly. Delvac and Rotella Tay, anyway.
My John Deere.
Yeah, like I pulled it out the shed and I put it in the circle, round car. And no, I'm sorry. Everybody else defended.
Okay, that's fucked up.
I'm not that sorry. I'm kind of sorry. I'm not that sorry.
You changed.
Anyway,
no, he hasn't.
So the point is that, like, people use that, right, because diesel oils had a higher shear, right, all that stuff because of the phosphorus and the zinc content. But now it's been outlawed. You can't have that much zinc because if the zinc burns off, it's carcinogenic and all this fun stuff, and people don't want to die anymore. And so...
Like, that's a new thing.
I mean, let it fuels were around until the 70s. Let's be honest. People wanted to die.
Well, I mean,
like, they just didn't know it.
A lot of people, like, want zinc in their oil.
Like,
anyway,
in their hands and shit.
They don't necessarily... I'm trying to think in a 4G63 why you would ever need really more zinc, and I can only think it's at the ball for the the hydraulic lifter. That's about it.
Correct. Yeah, yeah.
Like,
absolutely.
I'm in a super world where we're essentially flat tappets, right? We're a bucket, right? So yes, we definitely need it for lubrication, that sort of thing. So zinc's great in the old EJ. FA's the same one where it's they're little follower. It's not being a follower. It's kind of a rocker arm, really.
It's still good. I mean, it's still good to have the zinc, but people need these crazy, they think they need these 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 parts per million zinc contents. And it's like
the Lucas Breaking Oil, the fire called Lucas Breaking Oil, is some outrageous amount of zinc.
Yeah.
Like bonkers.
And I'm like, calm down, people. And then you can get like the additives to add more zinc in it. And I'm like, your oil is just zinc now.
You're pumping a zinc
like
slurry.
You put it on your hands and you can paint with it. Like, stop it.
So in reality, the oil market has changed so much and so fast. And without being able to, you don't know it's in each oil. The best thing you can do if you really be anal is go to Bob the Oil Guy. He's got a great forum for oil. I'm sure you're familiar with that, Mike. But on top of that, honestly, if you're doing...
Tell us more about Bob the Oil Guy. I have no idea what you're talking about.
It's a forum. It's a forum focused around oil. They do studies. They like you can go. It's actually got a lot of good information on there.
Yeah,
and so there's all these things on different oils, base stocks, and so like you see what base stocks they are. You see what ad packs people have tested them to be.
And even then, and so there's a lot of recommendations. They'll do revisions. So for instance, like Rotella 5W40 used to be like the go-to for like the super guys, because in the diesel world, zinc is good. Flat tappets, you know, basically the buckets lifters that we have in Subarus. It's really good for it, and so they like that. But then they changed the formulation 3 or 4 years ago, so we have a big nerd out thing. So Bob the Oil Guy had a whole thing on, well, here's the next version of what was the same oil you used to run, and it changed, and the formulation does. And so, yeah, you can go way down that rabbit hole. For just getting back to what Dan wanted to know, is I would essentially take someone who's either discuss with the time attack guy or the engine build guy, whether it be a guy who makes big power, tell him you essentially want a big power street setup, and kind of tell him it's really for road racing, so it'll be a lot of heat, a lot of load, this, that, and the other, kind of give him the rundown. Or if it's a guy who doesn't build your particular engine, but is a very experienced engine builder in general, kind of tell him your running conditions, how hot it gets, coolant temps, oil temps, that sort of stuff. And know that realistically, with either of these guys, you're probably going to have to get an iteration or two in on, like, refresh rebuild before you're really at, like, a great package for what you need. Not that it's necessarily going to blow up, because he'll probably play it safe. Talk with him, tell him play it safe. And again, kind of the same thing with oil. You can run a heavier oil. It's not going to hurt you so long as you're at an operating temp where it's not, you're not pushing molasses, which anyone on track's not going to do. Just make sure it's up to temp before you get out there. Because in reality, if you're running heavier oil, you're just going to lose some horsepower. At this point, I don't think anyone's worried about losing a few horsepower here or there, because otherwise you'd be worried about your piston package and all kinds of other stuff and developing that a bit further. And no one's really, at this level, kind of what we talked about last time, no one's cutting teeth for the last 5 or 10 horsepower. We're not at that level of racing. We're not at a point where 3 kilowatts is the difference between first and third in a championship.
And if we're honest with each other, like the problem though is like cold startup and then not warming up things. That's like the biggest problem.
Absolutely.
In reality. Mm-hmm. So when I used to do oil analysis and engine analysis and durability testing on large catch insets and stuff, like the starting of the engine, they always say, starting of the engine causes a lot of damage. And that is true. It does cause a lot of damage because, you don't have the oil pressure already. You can prime. We prime, right? It's common. We prime. And so you do that so you can flood the bearings and make sure at least oil's where it's supposed to be. But it's still not perfect. It's not great. So you don't have that lubrication. You don't have that pressure that you really need to keep things, there's a shear value there, but pressure helps as well to keep it flooded.
And beyond that, everything's not at operating temperature, so your clearances.
Right.
You can have oil there. Right. Even if your oil's hot, everything that it's touching is not at its proper clearance for running. And that's the thing that a lot of people miss. And it's like one of these old things that you hear where, an F1 piston size so perfectly that if the engine's cold, the piston will seize in the bore.
That's it's locked nonsense. Up. Yeah,
it's the opposite direction, if anything. The piston expands more than anything else because it is the hottest. So if anything, the piston will be loosest in the bore when it's cold.
It
flops around piston slab.
Hot dog going a hallway.
Yeah, so, but it's still one of those things that even if you fire up, your piston's still loose. And guess what? Your wrist pin's really big to the bore of your piston, which isn't going to be hot until your piston actually gets hot. So that means the piston, your pin bore on your piston's actually going to be rubbing a little bit. And likewise on the connecting rod, it's going to be a little tight, but at least it's got a bronze bushing or a brass bushing or whatever. Whatever they're making it from for your manufacturer. Now, you get high-end stuff, they'll actually bush pistons, too. But that's a whole separate thing. That's a friction problem. But all these things, your cam journals, your camshaft, steel doesn't expand as much as your aluminum head. So when your aluminum head gets hot, it becomes a bigger hole that your camshaft's actually looser in. But at cold start, your camshaft's really tight in that hole. All these sorts of things. Same with your crankshaft. Same with everything. So it becomes one of these, even though the oil's hot, the engine's not hot, which is why I'm a big fan of preheating your engine. For the EJ guys out there, you can buy a factory heater. plug the damn thing in and heat it up. Like, if it's your race car, treat it like a race car. No race car goes on track with a cold engine or a cold gearbox. End of story.
And if you, like, if some of them, if you look at people now, people in Time Attack know a little bit more because Turk has his Judd engine in a V10 in his Supra. Yep. Like that, they're preheating. They have a whole preheat process because it's a race engine. It's a requirement. If they just tried to start that up, that wouldn't go very well and that engine wouldn't last very long. And so they preheat oil, they preheat coolant, they get everything right before they actually start even think about moving. And so that's a big thing for sure. And reasonably, the difference in cinestoke, which is flow, basically the flow of the oil is measured in a cinestoke value, the viscosity of the oil, I should say, reasonably between different weights, once you start getting up to higher temperatures, 180, 200F, 220 especially, those cinestoke values start to get strikingly close. And so the low temperatures are the problem. The high temperatures really aren't. So you wouldn't reasonably, you don't even lose that much horsepower at the higher temperatures with heavy oils because...
It's part of why I'm curious why
those
guys
thin out.
NW30. I'm surprised you guys are on like a 0 or 10.
Well, so we did run a 0-20 for a while. So
I also say like a 0-40. Anyway. And in my experience now, be it I haven't run a lab with cinestoke stuff in years and years and years and years. But yeah, it was one of those like a 0W40 or 5W40 at the time and a 10W30 ended up being really close to each other. It's almost like
I don't remember, but I think it was like 2 cinestoke. It's like...
Like, I'd almost be like,
that's 2%.
In my mind,
it's like, whatever.
I just go to the 0-40 because it's thinner at the bottom end. You get very close at the top end. But at the bottom end where you're really concerned about having good lubrication on startups so you're not damaging stuff.
Exactly.
Like, a Mobil 1 0W40, the Euro blend stuff, like, it's impressive.
Right. And that's why, just so people understand, and that's why you see these crazy numbers. Like, back in the day, everybody had a 10W30 or whatever, or 1540 or whatever in diesels. And now you're seeing all these cars going to these crazy, you know, 0-20s, 0-15s, you know, if you look up, I don't remember what it was, but we had a look at the oil for F1 at one point. We talked to the Mobil guys and they were talking about how they're running, they're starting to test negative numbers, negatives, like less than zero, because the zero value isn't necessarily right. It's not an end all be all. You can go past it. It's not a hard.
Yeah. It's like any dive or other geometry on a car. You can technically.
And so they're talking about these negative numbers and people are like, what? And it's like, well, if you look at any like OE car, all this stuff, like everyone's trying to get more efficiency out of it. So the best way to get more efficiency is to reduce friction based on oil pumping. But if it's all the same or reasonably close, if it's all very liquid, right? Very, you know, very flows very well at high temperatures, then what does it matter? Right. Why does it matter? And so that's why they're using these oils that are better at low temperatures so that you don't get, you know, so, you don't have the propensity to have this bad fuel economy at low temperatures,
right? Real world.
Back in the day.
Real world scenario.
Yeah.
When all set, Volvo powertrain. So doing, 11, 13, 16 liter semi engines, over the road truck engines, or lorries for any UK listeners we might have. So we had, I think at the time was 1540 conventional is what was recommended. Now, mind you, these trucks are something like, you're talking gallons, like 20-gallon oil change or something. They're massive. Right. And they'll run 30,000 miles before you do an oil change because they're running around the clock, right? So the amount of downtime would be nuts. But at the time, we'd done a 5W30 synthetic. It was a high shear 5W30. And it has a fuel economy gain, this, that, and the other. And it helped us with, you know, of course, what the, you know, EPA and CARB wants to see. And like, here, we have this. But it was still option them. You can run a 15W40 conventional, or you can run this 5W30 high shear, you know, synthetic that we have that gets you, you know, I don't know, a mile per gallon better. And on a big truck like that, where they're getting 7 miles a gallon or 8 miles a gallon, that's a big deal. You do this versus that sort of thing. And that's real numbers. It was 15W40 versus a 5W30 synthetic. And one had a noticeable gain in fuel economy and the other obviously didn't. And
I mean, that's important from a real world
perspective. And this was, you know, 15 years ago. So, you know, what's out there now? Even better.
Yeah, it just keeps getting better.
The oil game is improving so much.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. And that's why people are obsessed over the oil, and I get it to an extent, but it's like, I just don't care. I just don't care anymore.
It's like the rules. Mike, what do you care about anymore?
The rules will just change. What's even worth caring about? Are you becoming a nihilist, Mike? Is that what's happening?
Oh, my God.
I mean, I've always been a nihilist. What are you talking about? But it's just like, because like people, again, we talked about it, like you're not going for that last 5, 10, 15 horsepower, whatever. So all these people ask these questions like I said.
Like you're building an F1 car?
To,
yeah.
Right. Yeah. I'm not trying to act like you're not important. You're important, but it's like these tiny changes that you're talking about are not what you should be.
I agree.
You have
largely
a mountain of low hanging fruit on the car. Stop.
Yeah.
And evaluate.
And like my biggest thing talking about this evaluation of, for instance, someone going through, if you were to start doing a program and you have a boater you like, and you buy some like boat anchor I-beams from some, you know, off the shelf manufacturer. I'm not saying a name.
There it is.
I'm not saying a manufacturer. I mean, take your, you own a pair. Don't lie, Devin. It's okay. You got a pair for your 2J.
See, that's close enough to name it, though, man.
And you got some heavy, chunky pistons. Fine. So be it. You go ahead and run them, and you read them and see that those are great, and the rods are fine. And if you're happy knowing that you have heavy rods and you're leaving time on the track, so be it. It all comes down to what you need. So if you're happy having rods that last 3 or 4 seasons, but you know it's at the detriment of you're not putting down your best lap time, don't be mad when you're not putting a lap time because you're also not paying to have the rebuild. Like, right. It's a win-win. You'll find your point where you're happy. And the piston, I think, is probably the bigger place for people to do an evolutionary package. Rod, you can knock a lot of weight out. Piston, you can knock a lot of weight out. Obviously, half the rod is considered rotating mass. The other half is reciprocating mass. Reciprocating masses, it's a big factor. So, you know, the rod only has so much to say, whereas the piston has a lot on the other end. Same with your wrist pin package. And then also on top of that, once you start developing that piston package with that builder, you know, get an ideal case. You've run 2 seasons, you take it apart. Here's where we are. Read the piston, get some feedback, get a custom piston, slight tweak. Same dome, same things, just a slightly different cam profile, right? So it's a little bit of a different taper to it. Fits a little bit better. Your wrist pin bore is going to fit you a little bit better because you're running at these temperatures. You start seeing some of these, you know, wear marks that you have. And you know what? That wrist pin held up just fine. It hasn't bent at all. It looks fine. Let's go to a tool steel and knock some weight out of it. You start doing these slight things. All right, we'll toss a DLC on it. It's a little bit more, but it'll lubricate better, so we're not going to have this at a cold start, so we're not going to wear out the piston as soon. And you start getting all these little tweaks done, and before you know it, you have a piston package you're really happy with, and it lasts you longer, and you make more power and have faster lap times. And it just kind of becomes one of these things you can do if you choose to. And it doesn't really cost you any more because you got to do a rebuild anyway at some point in time before you blow it up. Because if you don't rebuild it, blowing up costs a lot more. We discussed that last time. But
your common sense makes no sense.
I know.
So, on the topic of leaded fuel that Mike brought up earlier, it reminded me of this dude. So I wanted to randomly give people some information, even though everyone will probably hate it. So the guy who invented leaded fuel, Thomas Midgley Jr.
Yeah, it's like the worst person in the world.
Is like the worst person in the world because he could use ethanol or lead to have an anti-knock compound for gasoline originally, and he could make a lot more money on the lead blend, so he went that way. And so leaded fuels is horrific for all of humanity. The next thing he did was he created Freon, which obviously put a hole in the ozone layer. And so he is considered a one-man environmental disaster. He has had a more adverse impact on the atmosphere than any single organism in Earth's history. At the age of 51,
That is a fucking flex, bro.
Isn't it, though? Towards the end of his life,
he
contracted polio at 51 years old. And developed an elaborate system of ropes and pulleys to lift him out of bed. He ended up being killed by his own device after being entangled in it and dying of strangulation. So, I don't want to laugh at this guy. I mean, he's ruined millions of lives.
Well, I'll also say beyond that is there's been studies done of how leaded fuels literally destroy IQ points.
Sure.
Well, that's
like
that's
entire generations before us who are inhaling leaded fumes, not by their own choice. They're just children riding along in, you know, the family car with no catalytic converter, like just sucking up all the leaded fumes that smell. Honestly, I do love the smell of leaded fuel. I do. It smells fantastic.
Oh, God.
Most of us do.
Like, but at this point, I just know it's like, oh, brain cell's dying. Yeah.
But there's really strong evidence to suggest that the banning of leaded gasoline had a larger impact on felony reduction than policing has had, because all the dumb people out there.
He didn't say it.
I was going to say it.
I'm curious about this because this coincides with another study I've seen done about. Well, I don't want to get in political stuff here, but abortions, the unwanted children. There's a whole study done there.
Oh yeah.
And how that reduced. Anyway, we're way off the track of cars at this point, though. But yeah.
Oh, leaded fuel. That's interesting. But they say leaded fuel, in addition to dropping IQ points, increases your aggressiveness. And so by reducing leaded fuel, people got smarter and they became less aggressive. And so violence dropped. But yes, I'm with you on the whole Freakonomics thing too. For so
lead makes you aggressive.
Yeah. Constant exposure to lead does something to your brain that you have a tendency to be more violent.
That's pretty wild. I had not heard that one before.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Whatever. All right. So we're getting a little long again. So. Okay. getting a little long again. Is there any last questions before we wrap this one up?
Nope. Fuck them.
Okay. Yeah, I was like, no. All right. Thank you.
Are you gonna come on more often, it seems?
Maybe this will be a
monthly thing.
This is always fun. Yeah. I don't want to talk about the Easter egg car. I think I should save that one for a while. We need to actually make that happen. That's what needs to happen.
Again, about being poor. Did you keep forgetting that part?
There's one for sale right now. $6,000.
$6,000?
Yeah. Full running car, original engine, original everything in it, original interior, everything. $6,000. It's up in D.C. I know, it's ridiculous.
Okay, all right. We're just going to end it just like that.